word would shake Dascom out of this state that, to an honest copper like him, looked close to madness. "Pray that I do," Dascom smiled, turning back to the device. And Finch, knowing that any race to get a disposal unit here in time would be won hands down by the bomb, began to pray very earnestly indeed. Outside the studio, Jones had managed to shepherd the unmasked studio executives past the two policemen left guarding the torch-down door, and so, he hoped, to safety. He was about to go back in and get himself a piece of whatever action was left, when he heard another shout from the still-befogged studio.
"Wait!" came the cry. "Don't shoot! Wait for us!"
Two more masked men, like all the others wearing capes, came rushing through the door. Jones jumped back, uncertain which of the two to train his gun upon, hoping desperately that the other two guards would cover the one he didn't. "Damn it," he thought. "This wasn't a situation for poor bloody infantry like them to sort out." But no superior officer was in sight. Seeming to shove each other aside in their haste to escape, the two masked men lurched into the hall, the first suddenly pushed somehow by the second, and desperately trying to retain his footing, barging into the three cops and scattering them. By the time they'd regained their wits, the second man had stumbled awkwardly, his hands still fixed behind his back, and gone sprawling on the floor. And then he began to yell. Yell words that, just then, were the last things that Jones wanted to hear.
"Shoot!"
he shrieked, looking up toward his standing companion.
"Dear God, it's him! Shoot!"
The upright man hurriedly spun round, though strangely did nothing more than that, to face the three policemen who had by now regained their composure sufficiently to ensure that all three pistols were pointing dead straight in his direction. But that was about as far as their composure went. The wonder was that none of those three pistols had yet gone off.
"On your knees!" screamed
Jones, the note of rising panic obvious in his voice.
"Get down on your knees!"
And, to his enormous relief, the man actually did. Slowly, awkwardly, silently. No one moved. Someone had to. Blowing out a breath, and then sucking in an even larger one, Jones raised his free hand, gesturing for the other two to stay back and cover him. Then, holding his gun before him, almost as if it were a crucifix with which to fend off a vampire, he took a slow pace forward. Another, yet more slow, then tentatively, nervously, reached out to pull off the man's mask. And, ripping it away, revealed Fred Thorpe, the security guard, his eyes stretched wide with terror, his mouth stuffed full of gag. And before any of them had time to react, V had risen from the floor as swiftly as a striking cobra, all pretense now thrown aside, the real V, his hands not bound in any way behind him, but rather holding long knives. So sharp, those blades, and such a silvery glint along their edges it was almost beautiful to see, until they suddenly crimsoned for a moment, and after that were never seen again. It was over in an instant. Jones never got off a shot, being closest as he was, though his companions did, but all their bullets found was a billowing cloak swirled out around their target, confusing their aim like a bullfighter's cape, no red rag this, but simply formless shadow. And then there was no time for further shooting. There was only time for screaming, and the noise of cracking bone, and the wicked, slicing sound of sharp knives sinking into human meat, and falling bodies, and sightless eyes, and slowly spreading pools of thick, coagulating gore. Poor, bloody infantry. It was only sweat that was pouring from Finch's brow back in the studio control booth, as he watched Roger Dascom, still somehow bathed in that glow of serenity that Finch himself was desperately wishing for, almost certainly about to bring their lives to a shattered, shredded end. And if he didn't, the clock, now rapidly nearing zero, quite definitely would. The clock and the bomb attached. How did it feel to be blown to bits? Finch didn't really know, but was rather afraid he'd soon find out. And it wasn't much comfort to think he wouldn't be alone in the discovery, or that it would almost certainly be quick. 2 or 3 minutes had passed while Finch had assumed that Dascombe was examining the bomb. But then he realized he was doing nothing of the sort. He was simply using the last moments of his life for some sort of demented contemplation, until there was no time left for anything else but decisive action. And now that time had finally arrived.
"Here we go," said Dascombe coolly, and clipped a wire. A tiny noise, but in the frozen silence of the room more than enough to make Finch jump. He blew out a nervous breath and raised a thankful glance toward heaven, then realized that no one else had made a move or said a word. Looking back toward Dascombe, he saw the man still down there on his knees, his eyes still fixed religiously on the clock. The clock that still continued to tick down the last few seconds with a horrid, glacial slowness. 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Nothing. No explosion, no screams, no noise, no pain. No death. And then the tension broke, restoring Roger Dascombe to almost human form.
"I did it!"
he exclaimed, face alight with quite another excitement now.
"I did it!"
"Damn," muttered Finch, there seeming nothing else to say. And leaving Dascombe to his triumph, he turned away and began to push his way through the crowd at the door, some laughing, some looking nauseous, some just slumping to the ground, depending on how the stress and its relieving took them. He was sure he'd never like Dascombe, but he had to admit that when it came to the things he sincerely thought were important, the man certainly had balls. Not much sense, perhaps, but balls. And because of Dascombe's demented foolhardiness, they'd managed to put a stop to one of their foe's relentless attacks.
"And now I've got to catch him," he added, to no one in particular.
Not far away, Evie Hammond was hurrying along the corridor toward the elevators, hoping desperately that now the fire alarms had been switched off, they would have been restored to full function as well. But not far from Fred Thorpe's still vacant security station, she suddenly glanced up. And there, coming from the direction of the studio in silent haste, was V. All her guts knotting up at the sight of him, Evie ducked into a doorway and simply hid. Ridiculous as those old stories were about ostriches hiding their heads in the sand, now she could see the logic behind them after all. If it wasn't the police, it was V, and she just wanted all of them to go away. Wanted to get home and hide her head under the bed covers, then to wake up tomorrow morning and find that everything was once again the way it had been yesterday. And for today and last night to have simply never happened. Yes, there was something enormously attractive about V, despite that she had no idea of his looks. A sense of wildness and freedom, and the potential to be so much more than any normal person ever would, but at the same time that wildness and that freedom were terrifying. And the violence only made it worse, especially to one who feared the world as much as she did. So hide, then. Wait until he'd gone, and then try to slip away before he or anyone else noticed. But to know when he'd gone required risking a glance round the corner before she dared to make a move. No, not yet. She'd guessed the timing wrong, and he had only just arrived at the elevators, reaching out to press the button and summon up a car. But when his finger was a mere inch away...
"Freeze!"
Dominic Stone's voice rang out first, and then the young policeman himself appeared, emerging from his hiding place behind the security desk. His gun was firmly held in a two-handed grip, and it was pointing with absolutely unerring aim directly between the masked man's eyes. And there was something in his handsome bravery that she had to admire, or would have done anyway under any other circumstances. Right now, though, he was the last person she wanted to see.
"Get your hands on your head!"
he shouted harshly, tension edging a voice he was, with some small success, struggling to control.
"Do it now, or I shoot!"
As if her previous terror weren't enough, by now Evie was thrown into a complete panic. A few seconds ago the course of action had seemed obvious. just wait a little longer for the situation to clear, then escape. But what on earth was she going to do now? If V was arrested, and the rest of the police came back here to this landing, she'd never get an elevator. Probably never reach the stairwell either. Whether they got V or not, they'd still be after her as well. And besides, if V was arrested now, things would never change. No wildness, no freedom, no potential. Just eternal Adam Sutler, and Fingerman, and terror. And which of those alternatives was actually the more terrifying? "I must say," V declared, a few paces away and with his hands now firmly placed behind his head, "that I'm rather astonished by the response time of London's finest. I hadn't expected you to be so Johnny on the spot."
"We were here before you even got started," Dominic told him,
eyes and aim never wavering from the target, concentration never lapsing for an instant. No point in telling him they'd come here looking for someone else entirely, and that him being here had just been a fortunate coincidence.
"Bad luck, chummy."
"Oh, I don't know about that," V told him calmly, not moving a muscle, but looking past the young policeman and farther down the corridor. Still, the gun didn't waver, nor the concentration. Even so, Dominic couldn't prevent the images that were rising up unbidden in his mind. The man who caught the terrorist. His picture in the papers, the television interviews, celebrity, promotion. Maybe even the police medal, though that didn't mean as much these days as it used to. When the hand tapped him lightly, almost tentatively, on the shoulder, Dominic jumped so much it was a miracle his jerking finger didn't pull the trigger. But that much he did manage to achieve. Looking round, though, was something he couldn't prevent. And there was Evie, right behind him, and looking absolutely terrified at what she was doing, the pepper spray held up and little more than 6 inches from his face, right before his widening eyes. And then she pressed the button. Screaming, blinded, retching in pain and shock, he reached out instinctively and managed to grab her wrist, twisting the spray away before she could do any more damage, making her yelp with the bone-crushing tightness of his grip. And then he was spinning toward her, attacking sightlessly, swinging the pistol like a club. Cold metal cracked against Evie's temple, and her legs buckled, sending her collapsing to the floor just as V moved forward and dragged Dominic away from her. No time for steel now, just instant, unarmed retribution. A straight-fingered knife hand jabbed viciously into the policeman's solar plexus, taking his wind and doubling him over in exactly the right position for a hammer-like elbow straight down on the base of his skull. Dominic was unconscious before his head hit the floor. And then, for the first time in a long, long while, V stood there over the prone pair of bodies, staring down at Evie, and quite uncertain what to do next. Not long afterward, television screens across the land blinked into life once more, reappearing with a somber and obviously hurriedly constructed caption, "Special Emergency Report." And in those same retirement homes, pubs and clubs, and middle-class family homes that only a short while ago had hosted V's interruption to the schedule for an audience both puzzled and enthralled, expectant viewers held their breath and wondered what they'd be getting next. What they got was Dick, this time without June, without the viewer-friendly sofa, and definitely without the reassuring "All's Well with the World" smile, but with a banner logo in the corner of the screen saying, "Crisis at Jordan Tower." "We are interrupting your regularly scheduled program," he began, as if the program hadn't already been interrupted, "to bring you this terrifying report of a terrorist takeover of Jordan Tower, which ended only moments ago." All this was said with a grim and dour expression to match his tone of voice. Then a pause, just to make sure everyone had got the point. The takeover had ended. There was no longer any crisis. Normal order was rapidly being restored. Professional as ever, and with a script written almost instantly by Roger Dascombe himself, who now believed that there was nothing beyond his power to do. A psychotic male terrorist, identified only by the code letter V, attacked the studios and control booth with high-powered explosives and other weapons, used against innocent, unarmed civilians in order to broadcast a message of hate. We have just received this footage of a daring police raid. At this point, the screen began to display an edited extract from the handheld, grainy video footage that Dascombe's crew had shot on entering the studio behind the police. Cinema verite, it looked, with its swirling fog and cacophonous volley of gunfire, its twisting, bleeding body and its screams. And cinema verite it was, except that the cry of "Don't shoot" had been edited out. And no one mentioned how many men in masks had been found in the studio, or that this one, now on life support in a nearby hospital but fading fast, was not, in fact, the right one. No one would know about that, of course. The main thing was to show the audience the gunshots and the blood and the obvious evidence that the terrorist was dead. Threat over. See how efficient the police and security services were. Feel safe. More to the point, heed the warning, don't try it, Buster. You too could end up like dead meat in the butcher's shop, the same as the masked poltroon who'd been talking all that crap a few minutes before, and getting shot dead like that, he was lucky. "This is only an initial report," Dick's voiceover continued, until the camera returned to him and his now much more reassuring smile. "But at this time it is believed that during this heroic raid the terrorist was shot and killed." And then, with just a hint of triumph and much more emphasis, as if the louder it was said, the much more obviously it would be true, "Again, from what we have been told by the authorities, the danger is now over, and the terrorist is dead." And somewhere on a hill in southeast London, a little girl who could have been Evie a dozen years before, and whose parents were already suspected of being dangerously free thinkers, said precisely what she thought, and what her parents thought, and half the population of the city, too. Bollocks! 6. Evie woke in darkness, a dull, throbbing pain in the side of her head that felt as if someone were thumping it insistently and sadistically with a rubber mallet, only to realize a little later that the throbbing was actually caused by the pumping of arterial blood through the bruised and sensitive skin where she'd been hit by the policeman's automatic. She'd always known there was a pulse there, but this was more like the crack of doom, a doom that just kept repeating itself over and over forever and ever. Reaching up to touch it, she found a cool, damp compress over the welt and wondered who on earth could have put it there. With that memory of how she'd been rendered unconscious, and all that had happened before it, came first horror, and then the realization that she was lying in a bed, still fully dressed. But not her own bed. Not in her own apartment. A weak ray of light was leaking into the windowless room from a door that stood slightly ajar. A warm, candle-like glow that spilled across the bed. And as her eyes adjusted, allowed her to take in just a little of her surroundings. The room seemed to have no walls, or rather, every inch of wall was hidden by bookshelves, all of them stacked horizontally so that even more volumes could be crammed into the available space, book upon book, rising up with the density of bricks so that it almost seemed that they and nothing else were supporting the low and vaulted ceiling that loomed above the bed like a stone canopy. More books than she'd ever seen, outside of a library. And quite apart from the shelves, there were more stacks of books rising from the floor, occasionally falling back to spill in untidied chaos, like breaking waves in a vast sea of literature. And near at hand, that soft light from the door picked out a few gold-decorated spines and gave their authors' names a hallowed glow. Oscar Wilde, Radcliffe Hall, William Beckford. Banned authors, every one, or so she had to think. Some of the names, such as Pierre Louis, she'd never even heard of before. Beside the light there came soft music from beyond the door. For a moment she wasn't sure what it was, but then she remembered it from long, long ago. the sort of music she'd last heard when she was just a little girl, the kind her father liked. Blues. Black American music. Band, like the books around her. And then she almost choked on a memory, rising up out of the past and threatening to strangle her with its sweet, cloying loveliness, of lying in bed on a Sunday morning with Teddy in her arms, warm and safe and 5 years old, entranced by the dust motes floating in a beam of golden sunshine, recovering from a childhood illness, and smelling Mummy's roast beef and Yorkshire pudding, and Daddy's pipe smoke rising from the downstairs living room as that same song was played on an ancient hi-fi. And how Daddy always mowed the lawn on Sunday mornings, and how there was wisteria growing against the garden wall, and there was always, always sunshine. And then she knew she was going to have to get up and find out what this was all about, before she burst into salty, melancholic tears. Beyond the door was a short passage that somehow reminded her of a wine cellar, leading to a larger room, more startling and more wonderful even than the bedroom book room in which she'd awoken, but windowless just the same. Like some sort of storeroom from a museum or art gallery, or both combined, the place was packed with artworks from the Renaissance to the modern, from art for art's sake to the commercial, from Titian to the comic book cover. Comic books themselves as well, abused as they were, though mostly of the underground, political or artistic varieties that never quite received the treatment they deserved. Still more books, too, with fictions from The Iliad to Raymond Chandler, philosophies from Plato to Foucault, works of the now-eradicated neo-pagan religions, and histories by the hundreds containing tales that it seemed no one ever paid any attention to anymore. More than this, there was all that could be saved of the popular culture, swept away by Suttler's fascist imperialism. The DVDs and videos, CDs, cassettes, and even old vinyl albums, blues, soul, Tamla Motown, gypsy music, protest songs, an endless cornucopia now tossed away like a fistful of dead roses. Again, there were movie posters, papering the wall behind all these foreground piles, Humphrey Bogart, George Raft, James Cagney. Old gangsters never die. But it seemed they'd been asleep for longer than she could remember. And in a corner, gleaming brashly with its chrome and plastic and electric lights, a 1950s jukebox, from which that same old blues came gently crooning forth. And Evie could only stand there like Alice in Wonderland, choking up with mingled melancholy nostalgia and equal portions of delight. So many things she thought were lost, so many things preserved. From out of the shadows, V silently emerged, capeless now, but still masked and wigged, still dressed in the same Jacobean tunic, breeches and boots.
"Oh!" yelped Evie, startled. "You scared me."
"My apologies," he said gently, a genuine concern quite obvious in his voice. "Are you feeling all right?"
"Yes, thank you,"
she told him warily, a little reassured by his tone but still uncertain about so many things, including his intentions.
"What is this place?"
"My home," he replied. And artificial as it obviously was, there seemed to be something genuine about the smile upon the mask. Or perhaps the smile was in his voice. "I call it the Shadow Gallery."
"It's beautiful."
Evie turned to let her eye run over the assembled treasures once again, always spotting new things she hadn't seen before. Was that really an Egyptian mummy case over there in the shadows? Or just some movie backlot prop? And those strange wooden carvings, like the ones she used to see in the Africa shop before Suttler's thugs had burned the place down. Japanese woodblock prints. Buddhas. It just seemed endless.
"Where did you get all this stuff?"
"Here and there," he said lightly as the blues tune came to an end, idly starting to wander round the room and taking in the display with a single all-encompassing wave of the hand. "Much of it comes from the vaults of the Ministry of Objectionable Materials."
"You stole them?"
Evie asked, wide-eyed, suddenly afraid once more.
Was there nothing this man wouldn't dare? Theft, violence, terrorism? And here she was with him, in his headquarters, consorting with an enemy of the state. What would they do to her if ever anyone found out?
Heavens, no! A gentle laugh added unexpected warmth to his voice. Stealing implies ownership. You cannot steal from a censor. I merely reclaimed them.
God, if they ever find this place, Evie began, but didn't quite complete the thought.
I suspect that if they do find this place, V told her, making light of the thought, a few bits of art will be the least of my worries.
You mean after what you've done? Replied Evie.
And then all the events of the previous day came flooding back, and the floor seemed to tilt beneath her feet.
Oh, God!
Suddenly all the wonderland around her didn't look anywhere near so wonderful at all, and her head, forgotten for a while in overwhelming novelty, began to throb once more.
What have I done?
She asked, mainly to herself, a hand raised to massage her forehead, as if that would somehow make her brain work the better.
I maced a detective!
A groan of despair.
Oh, no! Why did I do that?
You did what you thought was right, V told her, in an almost fatherly, reassuring tone.
No, said Evie, shaking her head in rejection. I shouldn't have done it. I must have been out of my mind.
Is that what you really think? He asked, and now somehow he reminded her of one of her old schoolteachers. Or is that what they would want you to think? Actually, though, now that she thought about it, she remembered that particular schoolteacher, intriguing though he might have been, was one of the ones she couldn't really bring herself to like. The one with a harsh, uncompromising view of the world, who saw everything in black and white and had no time for comfortable moral shades of grey, who had principles, the one who made her think too much, the agitator who would undoubtedly have been among the first to have had his head put in a black plastic bag. Not the bags the finger used as blindfolds when they took you away, though God knew she was terrified enough of those, the sort of bag they put a bullet through, that prevented the brains splattering everywhere. And then she couldn't help but feel, deep down in her bones, that the man standing before her, his true face hidden by the smiling mask, was exceptionally dangerous. Not just to the police, the state, or the world at large, but to her, personally, as well.
"I think I should go," she said abruptly, trying to suppress a sudden feeling of panic, looking round hopefully for an exit door.
"May I ask where?" he said in a calm, calming and oh-so-reasonable voice.
"Home,"
she told him, unable to think of anything else but all the safety and comfort that it represented, tawdry as it was. Strange how she'd been wanting to get out of the Paddington area for ages, to move to somewhere better. Now she couldn't wait to get back there.
"I have to go home."
"You know they're looking for you," he said slowly, patiently, as if he were having to explain things to a small child. "If they know where you work, they certainly know where you live."
"I have friends," said Evie desperately. "I could stay with them."
"I'm afraid that won't work either." She'd known he was going to say that, even as she mentioned the idea. Knew as well that he was right. She couldn't drag her friends into this by asking for help. Or rather, she couldn't drag them in any more. Undoubtedly they would already have been pulled in for questioning, and not at all of a pleasant sort, and these days innocence was no excuse, no protection. "I want you to understand, Evie," V continued, turning away from her now as if the words he had to speak were rather too hard to say directly to her face. "I didn't want this for either of us, but I couldn't see any other way. You were unconscious and I had to make a decision. If I'd left you, right now you'd be in one of Creedy's interrogation cells. They'd imprison you, torture you, and, in all probability, kill you, in pursuit of finding me." Evie knew that every word he said was true, but still they sounded like a death sentence. And in many ways they were, for whatever happened now, the old life she'd had was over, irrevocably and forever. "After what you did for me, I couldn't let that happen. V's words cut once again across her train of thought. I picked you up and carried you to the only place I knew that you'd be safe. Here. To my home.
I won't tell anyone,
Evie pleaded, desperation giving way to terror now.
I swear. You know you can trust me.
I'm sorry, but I can't take that risk. He turned back to face her now that the worst had been said, and everything else would only emphasize the point. Have you ever been tortured? People say things they'd never believe they would. Looking at her, he could read exactly what she'd do. She was so frightened and confused she'd say anything they wanted to hear at the first sign of a threat, if only it would save her. She wouldn't want to. She'd never forgive herself afterward. But her resolve would just completely collapse as soon as they started to question her.
But I don't even know where this is,
she countered, trying to convince herself that after all the things she'd already had to go through in her short and miserable life, torture couldn't be that much worse. But knowing deep down, of course, that it would be.
We could be anywhere.
You know it's underground. You know the color of these stones. That would be enough for a smart man.
What are you saying?
Evie shouted, close to losing all control.
That I have to stay here forever?
Only until I'm done, V replied, trying to calm her down again. After the fifth, I no longer think it will matter.
The fifth,
she said, puzzled for a moment, until she realized what he was talking about.
You mean a year from now? I have to stay here for a year.
I'm sorry, Evie, he told her, suddenly seeming deflated in the face of her angry rejection. I just didn't know what else to do.
You should have left me alone,
she yelled, losing it at last, yet knowing even as she screamed at him that she didn't really mean it, knowing he had no other choice.
Why didn't you just leave me alone?
Then, with tears blurring her vision and streaming down her face, Evie spun around and dashed from the room, back along the passage to the bedroom, which it seemed she was now going to have to think of as home. Because it was either that, or think of it as a prison. And she had no other home to go to now. Or perhaps forevermore. And V, surrounded by all the treasures of the past, all those things that made a solitary life worthwhile, could only stand and listen as the stillness of the night was rent by painful, uncomprehending sobs. And know that Evie Hammond's wasn't the only life that had changed forever. Windowless as the shadow gallery was, the only indication of the coming morning was that the lights had been turned up a little more brightly, and the smell of frying eggs. It was the eggs rather than the light that woke Evie, though if truth were told, she hadn't slept much at all anyway, and crying herself to sleep was one of those things that she'd hoped was long behind her now. Still, no matter how much pain or grief the heart and mind might bear, the stomach always has demands quite independent of its own, and Evie had always been prepared to get up for fried eggs. In the Shadow Gallery's kitchen, V was smiling to himself beneath the mask, preparing what the Americans had called eggs in a basket, though in the part of England where he'd come from, they were always called an Egyptian fish-eye sandwich. Quite why, he never knew, but he treasured the picturesque name as another fine survival from the past. Evie found him standing at the stove, the eggs starting to sizzle in the middle of the toasted bread before him, masked and dressed pretty much as usual, except for the cloak, and an apron tied around his waist, which she found at once both ridiculous and touchingly homely. A mother and a father figure, both combined.
V,
she asked tentatively, not really certain how his mood would be after their contretemps the night before.
"Oh, good morning," he said pleasantly enough, turning round and holding the pan and spatula away from the stove a moment while he talked.
"I just wanted to apologize for my reaction last night,"
Evie said nervously, trying not to stumble over the speech she'd been rehearsing every time she'd woken up in the latter part of the night.
"I understand what you did for me, and I want you to know that I'm grateful."
And then the words just tailed off, and refused to say themselves any more as she looked, appalled, at his hands. For V, too busy with his cooking, had neglected to put on his gloves. The skin of both hands was horribly scarred, as if from severe burn damage, and that not treated very well besides. What was left of the flesh was healed over now, but the resemblance to normal skin was marginal at best.
"Your hands?" Evie questioned softly,
but there didn't seem to be anything else to add. "Oh, yes," said V, quickly putting down the pan and grabbing his gloves from the kitchen counter nearby, turning away from her and hiding his hands as he pulled them on. "There," he said a moment later, turning back toward her. "That's better. I hope I didn't spoil your appetite."
"No, please,"
Evie put in quickly, suddenly filled with a sympathy that the previous day she'd never have thought to feel for this strange and baffling man, whose unrevealing reserve disguised almost as much as his mask.
"It's just... are you all right?"
"It's fine," he told her briefly, but by no means abruptly. "Fine."
"Can I ask what happened?"
He turned his attention back to the eggs. "There was a fire." V raised his head as if looking off into the distant past. "A long time ago. Ancient history, for some. Not really very good table conversation." And then, with little more than a mental shrug, he glanced round toward her, changing the subject. "Would you care for a cup of tea and some eggs?"
"Yes, thank you," she said eagerly, as if she thought he'd never ask. "I'm starving, actually."
With that, he nodded toward a small breakfast table and skillfully slid the eggs out of the pan onto a plate, picked up a knife and fork, and turned to set the simple feast before her. "Please, enjoy," he said, adding, after the slightest of pauses, "I've already eaten." Of course, she thought. To eat in her company would require taking off the mask, and there might be more than simple reasons of identification for avoiding that. And if his face was anything like his hands, did she really want to know what he looked like? But by then the eggs were hot in her mouth, and there was something else to think about apart from other people's features.
"Mmm, delicious,"
she sighed softly, mouth full and already forking up some more. "Good," he remarked, with all the satisfaction of a chef who just served up an 8-course banquet.
"Oh, God,"
said Evie suddenly, recognition dawning of a long-forgotten taste and bringing back a flood of memories.
"I haven't had real butter since I was a little girl. Where on earth did you get it from?"
"A government supply train." V's voice betrayed the smirk that obviously played about his lips. "It was on its way to Chancellor Sattler."
"You stole it from Chancellor Sattler?"
Evie spluttered, almost choking on a bit of egg. Was there anything he wouldn't risk?
"You're insane!"
"I dare do all that may become a man," V quoted at her sententiously. "Who dares do more is none."
"Macbeth,"
Evie tossed back at him, determined not to be outdone. "Very good," said V, casting a glance out into the shadow gallery toward his favourite bust, then nodding his head a little bit to indicate a query.
"My mum," she explained, finishing off the eggs. "She used to read his plays to me, and ever since then I've always wanted to act, be in plays or movies. When I was 9, I played viola in Twelfth Night. Mum was very proud."
A little smile played, unbidden, round her lips. Memories as sweet as that were few and far between. "And where is your mother now?"
"She's dead."
"I'm sorry." Evie nodded, well used to receiving this kind of sympathy. But then she was hardly alone in that. She couldn't think of anyone she knew who hadn't been touched by this sort of loss somewhere among their family or friends. She took a mouthful of tea, and they sat there for a moment, looking at each other across the table in silence, wondering what other secrets might still remain. Everyone, she knew, wore masks of one kind or another. It was just that V's was far more obvious than most.
"Can I ask you about what you said on the telly?" she said at length,
although she wasn't really sure she wanted to go back over the previous day's events. But if she was going to have to live here, and with him, for a whole year, she needed to know what was going on, what made him tick.
"Did you mean it?"
"Every word."
"You really think blowing up the Houses of Parliament is going to make this country a better place?"
"There is no certainty," only opportunity. Aphorisms and quotations. They seemed to make up half his conversation, Evie thought. Maybe even more. Sometimes she was impressed, though probably not as impressed as he thought she ought to be. At other times she just found it downright annoying. Was he really just a know-all with a photographic memory? Or was his manner of speaking just another mask, to hide his real self? Or was he, as had occurred to her on the first night they'd met, actually some sort of lunatic? Well, the only way to find out about that real self would be to keep him talking and to listen to the bits that weren't just learned recitation.
"I think you can be pretty certain if anyone does show up to join in," she said a moment later, "Creedy or black bag every one of them."
"People should not be afraid of their government," he said, slipping back into his teaching mode. "Governments should be afraid of their people."
"And you're going to make that happen by blowing up a building?" she asked, rising to the challenge now.
"The building is a symbol," said the man whose face was nothing more than that besides, "as is the act of destroying it. Symbols are given power by people. Alone, a symbol is meaningless, but with enough people involved as well, blowing up a building can change the world."
"I wish I believed that was possible."
Evie put down the empty teacup.
"I really do. But every time I've seen this world change, it's always been for the worse."
She stood up then, adding,
"Thanks for the eggs."
And with that she walked away and headed back to her room, leaving V still sitting there at the table, the expression on his mask as enigmatic as ever.
"Right there. What's he thinking?" asked Chief Inspector Finch, more to himself than Dominic, even though the younger man sat there right beside him.
Both of them were staring intently at a small monitor showing security camera footage from the Jordan Tower fiasco of the previous day, from one of the few cameras that the terrorist had somehow neglected to disable on his way in. Looking with total concentration at V, standing contemplatively over the unconscious bodies of Evie and Dominic, sprawling at his feet. "Is he considering leaving her? After she just saved him?"
"He's a terrorist. You can't expect him to act like you or me," Dominic said shortly, still red-eyed and raising a hand to feel the bruising at the back of his neck.
Understanding the man wasn't his major priority at the moment, just catching him. Catching him and getting him alone in a cell where he could kick 9 kinds of living shit out of the bastard. And as for the girl, well, Dominic wasn't the kind who'd normally go around beating up women, but for women with pepper sprays he was prepared to make an exception. On the monitor, V finally bent down and scooped Evie up in his arms.
"Some part of him is human," Finch pointed out. "And for better or worse, she's stuck with him."
Watching V carry Evie to the elevator one more time, and he couldn't remember how many times he'd watched the masked man do the same before, Finch finally turned the monitor off and swiveled his chair round to face Dominic, noticing the folder his assistant had brought when he'd come over to join him.
"You got anything else on her parents?"
"Yeah."
Dominic spread papers on the desk. "And it's not good. They were both interned at Belmarsh."
"Oh, no," groaned Finch.
The same old story again. How many thousands had disappeared? Good people, for the most part, he was sure, just because they'd disagreed with the party policy line, or protested at the takeover. How many families had been broken up while they were establishing the new order? Still, they'd been worse places than Belmarsh, he knew. Belmarsh was just where they took the politicals. There'd been other, fouler hells during the reclamation, for the degenerates, the immigrants, the heretics, and all the other labels they'd used to dehumanize the victims. How easy it was to forget that one was dealing with real people when they just became categories, to be sorted, filed, and then forgotten when they'd been removed from the records. It was still going on to this day. After all, nobody in the media or the government news releases spoke of this V as a man, as someone who might have feelings, a family, a history. He was just the terrorist. Of course, of all the categories who'd been dealt with in the reclamation, it had been the politicals who'd been the most troublesome, who'd put up the most resistance.
"Yeah," Dominic continued,
A little more sympathy in his voice now that the subject had changed away from his particular bête noire and back to Eva's parents. She died during the hunger strike, and he copped it when the military retook the shed.
That's terrible.
That's not the worst of it. Her brother was at St. Mary's.
Christ.
Nothing but bad luck there, the younger man concluded, with a shrug that implied, but what could anyone do?
So, we know her story. Now we need his.
7. To say that Lewis Prothero had an apartment worthy of a man in his position would be something of an understatement. The penthouse overlooking the Thames was more of a monument to a man in his position. Or, more to the point, a cathedral raised entirely in celebration of its owner. Lewis Prothero is God, it said. There is no other God but he. And this is where Lewis Prothero retires at night, for worship of himself. The large and lavish bathroom reflected this no less than any of the other rooms. Indeed, right then it reflected nothing but Lewis Prothero, for his face and robed figure were to be seen looking back from gleaming mirrors all around the room. And where there were no mirrors, monitors projected from the walls instead, each screen wired back to a central video unit that was repeating the evening's earlier Voice of London broadcast on a continuous loop. Somehow, then, the bathroom became a vast kaleidoscope, combining past and present, audio and visual. A myriad starry aspects of the divine Lewis Prothero, too wonderful for simple words ever to quite express. What more could a man wish to contemplate, stripped naked and leaving behind all the dross of the everyday world, than himself, the star and marvel of his age? And what better voice to provide accompaniment to his own than, again, his own?
"I'll tell you what I know," the Prothero of the monitor was shouting to the London mob,
and Prothero of the bathroom joined in.
"I know this is not a man."
The broadcast was, naturally, about that stupid terrorist who'd almost managed to blow up the studio, almost taken the great Lewis Prothero off the air. A mask-wearing clown, he thought. That's all he was.
"A man does not wear a mask," cried television Prothero,
as his living counterpart flipped open a mirrored cabinet to reveal row upon row of prescription medicine bottles, for none of which he had any legal prescription at all.
"What is he?" cried Prothero, sorting out his drug list for the evening. "A man does not threaten innocent civilians," the tape continued. "What is he?" Prothero threw back the feed line again, now with better timing.
"I'll tell you what he is," the monitor responded with precision. "What every gutless, freedom-hating terrorist is, a goddamned coward."
Strange how they always wrote that line for him to say, he thought, even when he was talking about suicide bombers. Who dared far more than even he, the heroic Lewis Prothero, would do? After all, he might say whatever was necessary in defence of what he believed in, but to actually die for it. No, thank you very much. He was officer class, and they had cannon fodder for that sort of thing. Still, calling other people cowards had never affected his ratings, and those were far more important than anything else. As the audience broke out into spontaneous applause, just as they always did, Prothero paused to gobble a handful of pills, chasing down the cocktail with half a tumbler of scotch. Ah, yes. That should do it. Before he could take another swig, the phone began to ring. Using the remote to pause the tape, Prothero picked up the handset and listened for a moment. That prancing, self-important little piece of shit, Roger Dascombe. Just because Dascombe attended cabinet meetings, and that was unjust in itself, it was quite obvious that Prothero himself was the only person fit to talk to Sutler on behalf of the mouth. No, actually he should be telling Sutler what to do, not receiving instructions from on high. And just because he dressed up like a nonce, and what was this drivel he was talking about now? Oh, that again.
"There will be no negotiation, Roger," he said flatly, disregarding that Dascombe was nominally his boss. "When I come in tomorrow, the paddy will be gone. I'm looking at the tape right now, and he has no idea how to light me.
My nose looks like Big Fucking Ben.
Dascombe began to whine, but Prothero was no longer listening, instead carefully checking his nose in the mirror against the one on the monitor. Definitely the thick Irishman's fault.
"Listen to me, you bleeding sod," Prothero cut in. "England prevails because I say it does, and every lazy sod on this show is there because I say he is, and that includes you. Find another director of photography, or find yourself another job."
That told him, Prothero thought, clicking off the phone. Then, picking up the remote and setting the Voice of London rolling again, he headed for the shower.
Dascombe. The terrorist. Everybody. Fuck them all. "I'll tell you what I wish," the taped voice came again, more brash, more bully-boyish by the moment, as Prothero turned on the faucet. "I wish I'd been there. I wish I'd had the chance for a face-to-face. Just one chance, that's all I'd need."
And as the shower began to stream, down in the lobby the elevator doors opened with a faint mechanical ding, while a black-gloved hand swiped an ID through the security panel. An ID with a familiar name and face, though not the one belonging to the hand. Evie Hammonds. Prothero, of course, knew none of this, sluicing down his well-rounded form in the enormous shower, while watching none other than himself upon a waterproof monitor, placed there specially for the purpose.
"This so-called V," his voice re-echoed, "along with his accomplice, Evie Hammond, neo-demagogues spouting their message of hate."
Nice delivery, that, he thought, as clouds of thick steam rose around him, coagulating like ectoplasm. But Prothero was wrapped up in far more than that by now. He was wrapped up in himself.
"A delusional and aberrant voice," said his television self. "Aberrant and abhorrent," he chimed in, embroidering on the theme. Ought to be writing his own scripts, obviously, as well as doing everything else. "Delivering a terrorist's ultimatum." "Treason," cried Prothero, taking the audience's part, responding to himself. "An ultimatum that was met with swift, surgically precise justice. No mercy."
"And the moral of this story, ladies and gentlemen?" his electronic persona asked, dropping now into a calm, reassuring voice that sought to put all the troubles of the past few days behind them. Prothero, smiling and winking to his own reflection as he stepped out of the shower, didn't wait for the recording, but delivered the punchline on his own.
"Good guys win, bad guys lose, and as always, England prevails."
And as the tape re-echoed that triumphant declaration, he clicked off the monitors, watching that much-loved image of himself fade to grey. And saw another face reflected in their glass, and in the mirrors. A bone-white smile, a fixed, mustachioed grin, hideous in its implication. A mask. Partly shaded beneath a broad-brim hat, mounted on black-caped shoulders, a combination of the Puritan and the Joker, an image of the grinning knight. A 17th-century incarnation of the Grim Reaper come back to haunt the 21st. V.
"Holy Christ!" cried Prothero,
half a shout of terror, half a gasp of despair. As he spun round to face the intruder, his foot slipped on the slick marble floor. His legs collapsed, and all those extra pounds of flesh accrued through years of increasingly good living slapped down wetly at V's feet. He lay there for an instant, gasping for breath like a beached whale as the sobering adrenaline pumped through his veins, then looked up, terrified at his uninvited, most unwelcome guest.
"Good evening, Commander Prothero," said V calmly, though rather less than pleasantly, looking down at him as if he were some pinned and wriggling insect awaiting examination, or dissection.
"Oh my God!" groaned Prothero,
suddenly and desperately hoping that there might be another deity beside himself.
"How did you get in here?"
Disdaining to reply, V seemed to be giving him a moment to recover from his panic before commencing with the evening's entertainment. And Prothero, still looking to retain some scrap of dignity despite his terror, took advantage of the pause to scramble away and grab a bath towel. The phone on which he'd been speaking to Dascombe earlier, however,
seemed too far away to reach.
"Don't worry," V told him, following the direction of his glance. "I've made sure our reunion won't be disturbed by any annoying late-night phone calls, Commander."
"Stop that!" snapped Prothero, annoyance mingling with his confusion. And something a little more than annoyance. "Why do you keep calling me that?"
"That was your title, remember?" V stepped closer, looming over him like the shadow of impending death. "When we first met, all those years ago..."
Cooling droplets of shower water now began to mingle on Prothero's quaking flesh with even colder sweat.
"You wore a uniform in those days," said V, a sudden hardness edging his voice. "You looked very good in it."
And then the images began to come back. Not video footage this time, no one saw any footage from those days anymore, but memories, emerging from their long-suppressed hiding place in Prothero's dank and rank unconscious. Lark Hill Resettlement Camp. Latest in a long line of venerable institutions. After all, the very concept of the concentration camp was a British invention, dating back to the Boer War, picked up by others, with enthusiasm. Auschwitz, Dachau, the Gulags, Guantanamo Bay, Lark Hill. Not that anyone called them concentration camps after the Second World War, of course. They were detention centres, or resettlement camps. Different names. Same nasty institutions. The razor wire fences, the watchtowers and searchlights, the brutes in boots with the soulless faces and the automatic weapons, the doctors with the scalpels not bothering with anaesthetics. The wire cages, where the naked prisoners huddled together, regardless of their sex or age, don't call them human beings, don't even bother with their names, the numbers forcibly tattooed upon their skins were surely quite enough, unwashed and wallowing in their own filth, and praying to their varied gods. Not the god, for, as everybody knew, the true god was an Englishman and had no time for Johnny Foreigner. The punishment beatings, the sexual abuse and humiliations, the photographs to laugh over in the officer's mess afterward, the torture rooms, the executions, the cremation ovens. And, yes, the human skin lampshades that one of the guards had made, a joke, he said, to keep up the old traditions. Besides, anything Herman the German could do, be sure that Tommy Atkins could do far better. Of course, the man had been disciplined for that, but all that meant was transfer to another camp, where he probably did the same sort of thing all over again. Being a psychopathic sadist wasn't the problem. Quite the reverse. As they always used to joke in the mess, with the jobs they did, camp guards needed to be more than a touch pathological to stay sane. It was just that this one had got a mite frolicsome. And there, bestriding his world like a colossus, his little hell on earth and kingdom of his own, Commander Lewis Prothero. So fine in his perfectly tailored uniform, and tailored then to fit a rather leaner and more muscular body, the sort the ladies liked, or so he told himself, but perhaps it was just the power. His mirror-polished boots, his horsewhip, his first delusions of grandeur, delusory in that his notions of his own grandeur had simply been far too humiliatingly modest, before he rose to the godhead that only television could bestow. Strolling along the blood-stained and ceramic-tiled floors in that special block, the one that only the top brass were shown, but only after the floors had been sluiced clean so he didn't soil his boots. The cells where the experiments were, or at least the ones who'd survived the ordinary horrors of the medical block. The experiments. One particular experiment.
"You?"
gasped Prothero, terror almost freezing the word upon his lips. A final image, then, from when it had all come to an end, a faceless silhouette against a howling inferno of flame, stalking his nightmares to a soundtrack of explosions and screaming men, the heart of the darkness that had haunted him ever since. The horror. The horror.
"It is you," said Prothero flatly, finally, knowing there was nothing more to be done and nothing more to say.
Not wet ceramic tiles beneath him now, but marble. Not blood-stained. Yet.
"The ghost of Christmas past," said the voice behind the mask.
And then the figure stepped forward, became silhouetted against the bathroom lights, became as black as death itself. Across town in Lambeth, south of the Thames, a phone began to ring in a night-darkened apartment. Nothing here of the overblown grandeur of Prothero's place. This was a small studio flat suited to a man living alone, a man who'd lost his family long ago and whose existence, as a consequence, was little more now than work. With his salary, the occupant could have afforded something better, but all he really needed was a place to sleep that was close enough, when the fuel shortages got bad, for him to leave the car behind and walk to work. Or at least a place to sleep when he was allowed to. Some time passed before the figure in the bedroom stirred, fumbling in the dark and cursing under his breath, then finally flipped on the light and reached out for the handset. "Yeah," said Eric Finch, barely awake, eyes half open, completely unaware of the time but knowing that this was not the time for routine calls.
"Finch!"
a panic-stricken voice bleated in his ear.
"It's Dascom!"
"Dascom?" queried Finch, uncomprehendingly. Why was that slimy little prat phoning him in the middle of the night?
"What?"
"I've already called the Chancellor," Dascom cut in hurriedly, almost tripping over himself in his desperate urgency to get the words out.
"We have to get control of the situation!"
Finch couldn't figure this out at all. He had no idea what Dascom was talking about. And more than that, he'd never heard him in such a state before. Rubbing the sleep from his eyes with a knuckle, he asked, "What situation?" Half an hour later, and still waiting for forensics to arrive, Finch and Dascom stood side by side in Prothero's bathroom, looking down at the former star's lifeless, naked body. Cold and paling as the blood, no longer pumping against the pull of gravity, sank down toward the floor, his was a two-tone corpse, white above and pink beneath. No knife wounds on this corpse to let the blood escape, no messy human meat exposed to view. A clean death, as far as murders ever went. By the body sat a single floribunda rose, petals open in full bloom, salmon pink, but blending into cream and yellow. And looking round the gilded palace of sin that was Lewis Prothero's bathroom, Finch was sure as hell that the man who'd been the Voice of London wasn't the type to put it there. Jesus Christ! What sort of life was the man living anyway? The bathroom was bad enough, but the other rooms...
Chancellor